Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starion Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starion, taking you farther. Learn more at StarionBank.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio broadcast and online stream, Main Street, across North Dakota this time of day. Today, we'll start our show with Karen Ahrens. She's been on before. She's a registered dietitian and a consultant, and she works with Hunger Free North Dakota to help deal with poverty and hunger issues across our state. Karen, thanks for joining us again.
Good afternoon, Doug, and it's so good to be speaking with you again.
Just remind our listeners what Hunger Free North Dakota is all about.
I am honored to serve as a coordinator for a network of organizations that all share the same goal of a hunger-free state. And so we've got groups brought together from groups that work on growing food to state agencies that help people get food to charitable organizations to rural organizations.
Well, how would you characterize the state of hunger in our state?
I believe from the data that we have available that things have intensified and have gotten worse in the past year, that all of us have been dealing with COVID-19's impact on us. So over the past year, COVID-19 has impacted all of us in many ways. And in particular, when it comes to food access, if you recall back, there have been supply chain interruptions and shifts, some volatility in the food supply. All of us who've been working have seen some kind of interruption in. Some of us have lost jobs, decreased wages, decreased hours. There have been changes in routines at work and school, and we're kind of facing an unknown length of time until more usual social interactions will be able to resume. But the good news is that so many groups across the state have jumped in and assisted in from everything from the Great Plains Food Bank to their partner food pantries and soup kitchens to state agencies who administer the federal food programs and the regional and county social service agencies that administer those programs to schools, childcare, all of those kind of groups, volunteers, businesses have all stepped up to help make sure that these impacts are not as bad as they could have been.
How do we define food insecurity?
Well, food insecurity is a lack of access every day to enough food to be healthy, enough food every day for a healthy and active lifestyle. So over the course of the last year, we have seen interruptions in that, whether it's for some of us the first time that we went to a grocery store and weren't able to find the kind of food or a particular brand of food that we'd hoped to find. So that has impacted our food access. But food, and then many of us are dealing with not knowing from day to day or week to week whether we'll have enough money and resources to put food on the table to feed our families.
I've seen a number that nationally, maybe 1 in 5 families is food insecure. Do we really know the extent of food insecurity in our state? And is this information difficult to track?
It is difficult to track, but there has been a new tool launched by the U.S. Census Bureau called the Census Household Pulse Survey. And it's an online survey that has been conducted about every couple of weeks or so, implemented in quite quick fashion, that's been tracking indicators over the course of the pandemic. And I have looked at that periodically to get a pulse on where we are in the state. And it seems like things were most impacting families in North Dakota around April and May. and that things are stabilized somewhat now, but we still have, I believe, more people than prior to the pandemic who are not sure that they have enough resources to access the food that they need.
The pandemic has spurred a lot of money spilling out of Washington into the various states, including, of course, North Dakota. If you put together the two COVID relief packages, the one last year and the one new this year, it's about $2.5 billion coming into the state. And of particular interest is the $1.9 trillion national relief package that was approved by Congress in the Biden administration, because that one includes a child tax credit that could literally lift families out of poverty. Could you elaborate on that from the perspective of hunger-free North Dakota?
This is really an exciting prospect that we have before us, that these plans that are starting to be implemented now can lift children out of poverty, because we know that children in families that don't have enough resources, don't have as good of health, may struggle with education and lots of other things that impact their lives all the way down the road. And that we have this opportunity now to make children's lives better is better for an individual child, their families, and for our whole future. So in North Dakota, based on where we were prior to the pandemic, there were about 180,000 children below the age of 18. And it was estimated that about 10% of those kids, or around 18,000 kids, were living in households that were below the poverty line. So according to estimates, the child tax credit alone, the changes in that will make that available to more families, will increase the size of the credit and extend that benefit to 17-year-olds. So one group called Center on Budget and Policy Priorities is estimating that directly because of just this one portion of the American Rescue Act plan, 4,000 children will be lifted above the poverty line, and another 10,000 of our North Dakota children will be lifted above or closer to the poverty line, and that nearly all of the children in the state will benefit from the provisions in this plan.
And the plan would give basically a $300 per month tax credit to families of kids under six, per child under six, and $250 for kids who are over the age of six. But it's a one-year plan. this could be a blip, or it could be perhaps permanent. What's your perspective on the odds of that?
Well, I'm not sure. I hope that once people understand that sometimes the people with the lowest incomes weren't able to benefit from this, and why was that happening? And why would we want to go back to conditions like that before the pandemic? Hopefully, the decision makers, policy makers will latch on to this being a good thing for families and children.
One of the complications is that people in poverty sometimes don't file taxes. And if you don't file taxes, you don't get a tax credit. How are you getting the word out that this is available?
That's not something that we directly do, but I know that efforts are working with trying to reach people where they're at and try to reach people in ways that they can see to make sure that they know how, like going to the library, for example, to access online services that our great libraries in North Dakota can provide to people. And those are just some of the ways that people are trying to be reached.
Karen Ahrens is a registered dietitian and the coordinator of Hunger Free North Dakota, which has been around about 12 years now. And we're talking about the child tax credit, the possibility of that lifting families out of poverty and making them less food insecure, which is specific to her mission. There are ideological differences, Karen, that you're well aware of about poverty and welfare. You once ran for the North Dakota House, and you are, you know, you live in Bismarck, so you're acquainted with the legislative process. Why is there that kind of difference over how best to help people who need help?
Well, that's a great question, Doug. I guess as some people have been looking back on our recent history or even further back, that there are those who believe, starting maybe with the Reagan era, that government is something that should get out of the way. But there are others of those in our nation's past. When in the period of 1965, that there were many programs started that assist people, and that sometimes when people believe that resources directed toward corporations or businesses will trickle down and help people, I think there's a history of that not happening. But I think it's time to give this a try. And with my belief in participating with government programs, being employed by government programs, I worked for the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction with the school lunch and breakfast programs for nearly 5 years. I saw the great benefits that brought to children in schools. I have followed and studied and advocate for federal food and nutrition programs, and I believe that they help. And I think at this time, more than ever, when people's incomes and lives have been turned upside down in some cases, that this is an opportunity to for all of us to give a little to help many of us who need it most.
One of the issues here is the word welfare. You mentioned President Reagan. He, I think, coined the idea of the welfare queen, which reverberates today. What if we call it a child allowance as opposed to, lumping it under welfare? What if it's a benefit that goes to people who are helping us, maintain our population and, train people for the future to govern our country and be our technological and educational leaders, that kind of thing. Other countries do that. Is terminology at all instructive here, or am I just blowing smoke?
Well, I think the way that we talk about people with less resources and people with more resources is really important. And I believe that everyone, most everyone in our state, can agree that children are our future, that when we do things to benefit children, that it benefits all of us. I think that's a place to start, that if you speak of directing our tax dollars that we contribute through our federal tax dollars or maybe our state dollars, the decision makers direct those in a way that help, that it's called a benefit. I think that can be helpful, like you say, Doug. But if we think of people first, I think that always helps to frame our conversations. So if we are talking about a population or we're calling a group as those people or that people who are not like us, but consider everyone within our group or neighborhood, is one way that I've tried to help people think about the way that we talk about and with dignity, respect each person.
As I was preparing for this discussion, I came across something that I'd heard about but hadn't really bored into, and that is Utah Republican U.S. Senator Mitt Romney has proposed a Family Security Act that would increase support for people in poverty above this new child tax credit and would actually get away from the necessity of filing a tax return to giving that responsibility to the Social Security Administration so that these child allowances or this Family Security Act money would go to people every month who meet the standard, the requirement.
Yes, and I think that there'll be lots of rich conversation as that moves through Congress. And I hope that people will come to the conclusion that if people are working in jobs that don't pay a living wage, and we expect that they can successfully raise children, that we think about that again and come up with some kinds of mechanisms, whether it's that one or other proposals that come before Congress, that we do the best to help children become successful and contributing adults to our society.
The legislature is, of course, in session, and they're dealing with all kinds of issues, including some bottom-line budget ones. What are you watching in particular?
Broadly, there have been proposals, not a lot, that directly impact food programs. There was a proposal to provide funding for school meals or even study school meals, which failed in the legislature. So watching those, watching the infrastructure bills, school funding is important. So kind of keeping tabs on all those things that impact people's bottom line, and hopefully making sure that we can continue as a society to be able to vote and participate in the democratic process as fully as we're as possible.
Well, we started talking about the pandemic, and of course, I would be remiss if I didn't remind people that you were probably in some newspapers this morning with an opinion piece saying a ban on mask mandates is dangerous. So, Karen, explain to us your position on mask mandates.
I am a member of the North Dakota Public Health Association Governing Board. I've worked in public health for many years, and I believe that masks, face coverings, during a time when we're living with a virus that spreads by respiratory droplets, is effective at helping to prevent the spread of the disease. That officials with broad and consistent guidelines can help reduce the spread of disease, keep people from being sick, keep people from dying. I think that that's a good thing, and I would hope that the bill that passed that would try to limit those powers would now be vetoed. Every time we talk and think about the pandemic, I like to acknowledge and remember that more than 1,400 North Dakotans and over 500,000 in the United States, lives have been lost to COVID-19. And so I'd like to also respectfully remember and know that we'll be dealing with those impacts for a long time, as well as making sure that public health is prepared for the future, for future contagions or pandemics that may spring up, that public health is prepared and is able to respond to help us all fend off disease and protect health.
Masks have been one of those polarizing issues with the pandemic and with ideology and with government. We're talking about specifically here, you were referring to in your opinion piece, House Bill 1323, which would outlaw statewide mandates for masks, although still allow them in other governmental subdivisions. We'll wait and see what happens with that. But Karen Ahrens, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much, Doug, and just encourage people to be able to take advantage of the benefits of the American Recovery Act plan that we didn't get to touch on, including health care. So check out again and see if people are struggling to find health insurance, to check out the marketplace at healthcare.gov and other things like child care benefits, food benefits that will be coming to help people make it through this tough time that we're in and look to the future that's better for all of us.
More information about Hunger Free North Dakota at hungerfreend.org. Tom Ezer is next.
Uh-oh, the kids are stuck home? Well, there is some help. Prairie Public reminds you about PBS Kids. It's on the television, but there's also pbskids.org, where you can find all kinds of educational and fun games and activities. pbskids.org or PBS Kids on Prairie Public.
I'm Dave Thompson. On this week's Legislative Review, we'll talk with Bismarck Republican Representative Mike Nafee about investing legacy fund income into the state of North Dakota, also the bonding bill, and how things stand as the legislature goes to its home stretch. Legislative Review is 6:30 p.m. Friday on Prairie Public's radio service, as well as on our digital platforms.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a Main Street regular. A distinguished professor of history at NDSU, he's the author of Pacing Dakota and the writer and voice behind our Plainsfolk essays. Today, his essay is titled Cattle Kings and Trick Horses.
If I use the word pastoralism, it's usually misunderstood. People think I'm talking about clergymen, possibly of the Lutheran variety, when really I'm talking of what we in the United States generally call ranching. In the rest of the English-speaking world, that's pastoralism. And if practiced on the open range, that's extensive pastoralism. And the open range is referred to as wastelands. So, in terms the rest of the world would understand, here on the Great Plains, we have a particularly interesting history of extensive pastoralism. It came about because we also have a particularly interesting history of transportation, by which I mean railroads. Elsewhere, in the history of settlement, people like Daniel Boone beat a pathway to the frontier, built their cabins, and hoped others would follow to raise property values. Eventually, investors built railroads and canals to connect settlements to the rest of the world. Here on the Great Plains, we flipped that process. First came the railroads, built with government funding. Then came the pioneer farmers to settle alongside and ship their produce. In the meantime, after the previous, that is, American Indian, pastoral cultures of the plains collapsed under pressure, we had open-range ranching, which was English-style extensive pastoralism outfitted in Spanish gear and vocabulary. While writing a general history of agriculture on the Great Plains for an academic work, I realized what I've been talking about is all a matter of what our animal science people nowadays like to call animal agriculture. So I had to fit it into the narrative, which wasn't hard, because we have a wonderful literature of extensive pastoralism, ranching on the plains. I'll mention just a few of the classic primary works in case you're building a personal library. Begin with Historic Sketches of the Cattle Industry of the West and Southwest by Joseph McCoy, 1874. McCoy was the guy with the bright idea of bringing the cattle trade to the little village of Abilene, Kansas, on the Kansas Pacific Railroad, thus transforming it into a global phenomenon. Move on, then, to Andy Adams' Log of a Cowboy, 1903, which recounts memorably how the cattle industry moved north to fill the plains. If you're not satisfied with that, get yourself a copy of Hunter's Trail Drivers of Texas, 1920, for a collection of narratives thick enough you can use it to block your pickup wheels when you park on a hill. A generation after the closing of the open range, the historians take the field. The original cowboy historian was Edward Everett Dale, a cowboy, deputy sheriff, and country school teacher from western Oklahoma, who got himself a couple of degrees from Harvard and settled in to teach at the University of Oklahoma, Stetson and all. There he wrote The Range Cattle Industry, published in 1930. To the north, we have Ernest Staples Osgood, a Massachusetts boy with a degree from Wisconsin who taught at the University of Minnesota. His book, The Day of the Cattleman, 1929, is the classic explanation of how ranching capitalists organized the open range of the northern plains. I do think Osgood is somewhat captured by his sources, which were mainly the papers of the Wyoming Stock Growers Association. Osgood began the trend of celebrating the so-called cattle kings as the aristocratic heroes of the open range. As best I can tell, however, that term was a bit of a spoof used to make fun of cattlemen with aristocratic pretensions. In the 1880s, there was a touring dramatic production called The Cattle Kings that was a great popular favorite. Its stars were a company of performing horses that were brought on stage. Then they exited the stage, as did the extensive pastoralists of the Western Range, once their time was past.
That's Tom Easern. Coming up on Main Street, a conversation about the Constitution. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The state Senate has approved a bill calling for a 5-year tax holiday for coal-fired power plants. The coal plants would have to pay a lignite research tax. Republican Senator Jordan Kanyanyan says it would make the coal plants more competitive on the daily wholesale electricity markets.
They would be able to compete better, sell more electricity on more days of the year, and thus be more profitable and be more viable. And with the distorted markets in which they exist, this bill is simply an effort to keep the industry moving forward, to keep something that's so important to our state moving forward.
Fargo Democratic Senator Merrill Pepcorn opposed the measure. He told the Senate he understands how important the lignite industry is to North Dakota.
But we do need to look to the future and start adapting to it and incorporating perhaps some of these other fuel sources and investigating them and researching them.
The tax holiday would induce annual taxes by $21.3 million a year. The measure is House Bill 1412. It passed 43-4, and it goes back to the House to see if it agrees with Senate changes. A number of rural telecommunications companies have applied for and received federal funds to help upgrade internet service in underserved areas. The program is called RDOF.
It's the Rural Digital Opportunity Fund.
This is Public Service Commissioner Randy Chrisman.
And it's a federal government program that helps provide broadband service to some of these poorly served areas.
Chrisman says this is robust internet service.
It has to be a minimum of gigabit service.
And he says these are places where it is hard to get good internet service.
So those folks, in some cases, don't even have adequate telephone service. But in for the most part, they do not have good internet service. It is an important function for daily life in the 21st century. And this is the way to get that out there and finally complete the puzzle and make sure that North Dakotans from one corner of the state to the other have that good, hearty internet service that they deserve.
And the state Senate has unanimously passed a measure that more clearly defines the qualifications of the state health officer.
We decided that a physician would have the respect of the public and have the expertise that we need as a health officer.
Republican Senator Howard Anderson says the bill specifies that the doctor hired needs training in public health. The bill is House Bill 1418 and now goes to Governor Burgum's desk. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
On the next State of the Reunion, we celebrate Poetry Month and find that even in this digital age, poetry is just as relevant as ever.
We're trying to give young people a place to define themselves against the definitions that exist out there in the media about them. So if you are interested in finding out what the young people of America are really about, check out your local spoken word show featuring kids.
That's on the next State of the Reunion.
State of the Reunion, this week's Prairie Public Presents, coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Ryan Yonk is Undergraduate Programs Director for the Center for the Study of Public Choice and Private Enterprise at NDSU. He also has considerable expertise about the U.S. Constitution. And that's the focus of his discussion with host John Harris in this excerpt from the Prairie Pulse television show.
Tell the folks a little bit about yourself and maybe your background.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as you said, I work with the Center for the Study of Public Choice and Private Enterprise at North Dakota State University. And one of my key roles there is actually Undergraduate Program Director, where I work with a variety of undergraduate student programs, one of which is focused on the U.S. Constitution, where we conduct a reenactment every year. There's been a little bit of media coverage about it, where students actually get in the sort of space of those that were there at the Constitutional Convention and talk about some of the issues that's come up. My own background is mostly in public policy, so all the questions that you'll ask about the Constitution, I'm probably going to respond with, how it affects public policy and what are the implications from that. I'm not a constitutional lawyer. I'm not a historian. And I must say, all the opinions that I will share today are just my own. They are not the opinions of North Dakota State University or the Center for Public Choice and Private Enterprise. You just get me.
Well, that's okay. And with that disclaimer out, What made you fall in love with the U.S. Constitution?
So I have been a giant Constitution nerd for a long time, since I was a kid. So in elementary school, one of the things we did, a great teacher set us up to read the Constitution and then talk about it. I mean, we were 7 or 8 or 9 years old, and we start to read it, and it inspired an interest in me to begin to explore the Constitution itself, the American founding. And my parents used to drive across the country transporting school buses. They're both school bus drivers. And so our vacation often was bringing a school bus back from the East Coast to Utah. And I became known as the brown sign kid who made them stop at all the historical markers across the country. I have a cousin who still cries in agony whenever she sees a brown sign because of it. But it's the idea that we both have a past, and that past influences how we make decisions today, I think, that really keeps me in love with the ideas of the Constitution, coupled with the fact that it still works. By and large, with all of our troubles, the Constitution still works for us today.
Can you give us a brief history on the Constitution? You know, who wrote it and who wrote the Bill of Rights?
Yeah, so the Constitution was a group project, a giant group project in Philadelphia, where they came together to try to hammer out a bunch of differences from the different colonies that would become the states, who all wanted somewhat different things in the new nation. They had fought a revolution from the British. They had won by some miracle. If you're a betting man, you wouldn't have bet on the colonies, but they managed to win the war, and now they have to build a government after their first try. So they first tried a loose agreement known as the Articles of Confederation, and they don't work because everybody's able to do exactly whatever they want, and participating with the national government is basically voluntary, particularly in providing money. And as a result, things didn't look particularly bright for the new nation. And so in the late 1780s, they come together to write the Constitution with the idea that they're going to have a governing document that will bind the nation together in a way and provide a way forward for the longer term. And ultimately, written constitutions go way back. The Magna Carta is probably the one people are most familiar with, the idea that there's a set of written laws that everyone, including the monarch in Britain or the President of the United States, must obey. And that's the goal of the Constitution. But it's also a document that comes about as a set of compromises. And if we read the text, we can see those compromises. They sort of leap out at us from the very beginning.
But how does all of that fit into our modern world in terms of practical public policy?
Yeah, so one of the things that comes up is we often talk about Congress needs to do this or Congress needs to do that. And in most public policy questions, that's right. But Congress or the president doing things exists against the backdrop of this fundamental set of rules. And so one of the things that policy sort of scholars and students have to remember is the choice set is not actually unlimited in American public policy. It's bounded by the rules of the Constitution, which created a federal system, reserving some powers to the states, giving some powers to the national government, leaving some powers completely off limits to government altogether in the form of individual rights. And as a result, the choice set is, as an economist, I would say, bounded, meaning limited. And so the Constitution provides a framework that policy has to hang on. Because it's sort of the background set of choices that all policy is made against.
Well, why does there seem to be so many differing views from person to person or judge to judge even?
Well, the Constitution is not a particularly long document, and it's not long for a lot of reasons. One of which is it was a compromise document. You had to get most of the people in the room to agree to it. A number of the original states never actually ratified. In the initial days of the Constitution. They had to get to a threshold for it to go into force. And so it was a compromise document. And beyond that, the power to interpret the Constitution wasn't resolved in the text itself. That comes about later with John Marshall and the Supreme Court, who claims for the Supreme Court the right of interpretation to judge laws against the Constitution itself. And as a result, different approaches to how to interpret the Constitution have developed across the couple hundred years of American history and American jurisprudence. And we've really ended up with three today. The first is the originalists. This is sort of, these are Scalia-type folks, folks that look to the original meaning of the text as it was in the time it was written. And then there are the textualists, who look to it, to the plain meaning of the text, who read the Constitution and interpret it based on what the words say and what they mean. And then there are those that are often called the living Constitution sort of approach, which is they look at what was the goal of the Constitution and interpret it in light of goals of equality and fairness and equal rights and interpret constitutional provisions in light of that. All of which are not unreasonable approaches to the Constitution, but they can end up with very different understandings of what the what the rules the Constitution lay down mean. And it provides a fascinating set of research questions for scholars, but it can be somewhat frustrating or confusing, I think, as we try to make policy in light of how different interpretations happen.
Okay. Well, you know, trying to think about January the 6th, and this has come up numerous times in conversation with protesters at the Capitol. They were there hoping to overturn the election results and maybe get Vice President Pence to discard the Electoral College results. What does the Constitution say about the Electoral College, and what are your thoughts on what happened?
The Constitution says exactly what happened, which is the states are in charge of the elections. The states select electors. Those electors are, the names of the electors are sent to Washington, D.C. The electors vote in their respective state capitals, and those votes are binding on the vice president as the president of the Senate. It's exactly what Vice President Pence said. It's exactly what he did, and it's what, as soon as people started talking about that he should try to overturn them, my response was that is not a possibility and it's not going to happen. Some of the, I think, frustration that boiled up was a result of the fact that elections are left to the states. Elections are state responsibilities, and states are left to judge the elections based on their own laws, their own interpretations. And so, as a result, there is going to be a set of different standards across the country. Now, we might not like that reality, but that's the reality that the constitutional order sets up. There are some things states can't do, like you can't refuse to allow people to vote based on race or gender or those sorts of things, but those are constitutionally protected rights. But the manner, the place, the form of elections are really state-level decisions.
Okay. Well, let's talk about free speech. It's a huge issue today and always has been, for that matter. But, you know, we seem to be seeing conflicts from the left and right about free speech, some believing with Twitter and Facebook canceling free speech or policing it, maybe, along with Big Brother stuff. Can you comment on this and maybe, you know, where is that going moving forward?
Yeah, so speech is this interesting problem for American history. Speech has always been at the forefront of the American discussion. And the Constitution is fairly blunt on the subject. It's one of the first rights enshrined, but its protections enshrined from government interference. I have no right to show up on a private broadcast station and say whatever I want. So you could say that's limiting my speech, but that's perfectly allowable under the U.S. Constitution. What can't happen is the government says I cannot speak, or the government intervenes to prevent that speech from happening or punishes that speech. And as a result, we end up with a discussion about the concept of free speech rather than the constitutional right to free speech. And I think the cancel culture discussions are about the idea of free speech, because free speech as an idea is important to a robust democracy, a robust society where that values diversity and plurality. But the much more narrower question of constitutional rights to free speech involve government action, not private action. And so we can have lots of discussions about should Facebook cancel, but it's not a constitutional issue.
So in a free country, is free speech essentially something that is often hard to listen to, but still protected? And what's that magical line on the issue?
Well, the easy part of that question is the magical line is whatever the Supreme Court says the magical line is. And the Supreme Court's had a lot of jurisprudence over the years about that line. There have been a number of cases brought that essentially recognize that, yes, uncomfortable, even hateful speech, speech that we would find repugnant, is protected under the First Amendment. The government cannot intervene to stop this, to prevent the speech from happening. Doesn't mean that speech shouldn't be socially ostracized or people should express counter speech. But the sum up in most instances of how to deal with speech that is hateful or bigoted or evil, I think comes from the idea that the best way to counter speech that we don't like is with more speech. And we watch this play out again and again and again, where as speech gets responded to, particularly when government doesn't intervene to set what the rules of the game are and really recognizes and values free speech, we see lots of speech in response to terrible speech. We watched it play out over the course from November all the way through January 6th. There was lots of speech all around it, and there was lots of counter speech. And so I'm a fairly doctrinaire free speech person. Government should stay out of the regulation of speech. And then I put a period at the end of that sentence. Sometimes that's going to mean I hear things I don't like, and I'm probably going to say things that people don't like. But we should have a dialogue, either directly or in society at large, where that speech gets talked about and problematic speech gets dealt with at a social level, not a governmental one.
Well, we'll move away from free speech and talk about the Second Amendment.
Sure.
Another article that leads to probably heated discussion. What does it say? What does it mean?
Yeah, so the Second Amendment is an interesting little piece of constitutional text because there has been an open and ongoing debate that has now been settled by the Supreme Court. It refers to a militia being necessary to the security of a free country. Therefore, the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. For most of U.S. history, that was interpreted as an individual right. There were questions raised about whether or not it was an individual right, and the court ruled in the last 6 or 7 years that, in fact, it is an individual right. And so the text is, the matter is currently settled. The Supreme Court can always change their mind, but ultimately the Second Amendment preserves the right of the people to keep and bear arms. But like all constitutional rights, it's not absolute. And so the decision about where those boundaries are will ultimately rest with the Supreme Court. So the answer I have to a lot of these questions, what does the Constitution mean? It means exactly what the Supreme Court says it means, no more, no less.
Okay, here's another subject that, real quick, Roe versus Wade.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing in the original Constitution that talks about abortion. But so how was this case interpreted by the Supreme Court?
Yeah, so Roe versus Wade comes out of a period in the court's history where they were exploring rights to privacy, rights to self-determination. And ultimately, the decision in Roe is tied to the right to privacy. That there are spheres of life where government is not allowed to intrude. Roe is a controversial case. I think that's a given. I don't think anybody would disagree with my assertion that Roe is controversial. Whether or not Roe is good jurisprudence depends on your perspective about any number of things. But it grows directly out of the concept of a right to privacy. And this is, I think, an area where Supreme Court jurisprudence is going to continue for a long time, where there's going to be lots of discussion about, is the right to privacy built into it? Where does it come from? Is it an equal protection? Is it in the limits on government? Does it reside in the Ninth Amendment, reservation of rights to the people if they're not specifically given to the states or to the Congress? But it's an area that's going to continue. Abortion will continue to be, and I think will always continue to be, a controversial issue in American politics, and one that I have lots of people on both sides of the issue that vehemently disagree, and the Supreme Court will decide this question again and probably multiple times.
Yeah. We've got a couple more subjects, and sure, we don't have a lot of time, but the Equal Rights Amendment's making some news in North Dakota right now. What is the ERA and why was it never enacted?
Yeah, so the ERA was a movement to enshrine into the Constitution equal rights between the genders, between men and women. It failed in large part because of a push by Phyllis Schlafly in the Eagle Forum, and it was in part in response to the feminism of the 1970s and the counter sort of push back against the feminism of the 1970s. I am actually not a fan of the Equal Rights Amendment. I think that we get to the same answer through the 14th Amendment's guarantees of equal protection. I have no issue with the idea behind the Equal Rights Amendment, but the Supreme Court has the tools it already needs to do it. And I think that it has the tools to do it across a variety of other areas of life that probably deserve similar consideration. And so the more carve-outs we create in the Constitution, the more difficult it is to use things like the 14th Amendment in jurisprudence.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's been some talk about the Supreme Court stacking, increasing the number of justices. Is there anything in the Constitution that limits the number of judges?
Nope, that is an entirely a congressional decision. By passing an act, they set the size of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is 9 because that's what Congress decided it was going to be. Congress could pass and the president could sign an expansion of the court. FDR tried this in the 1930s. It pretty well blew up in his face, and I am highly doubtful that there will be an attempt to stack the court again, partly because the 9 justices of the court has become both an American tradition and something that works relatively well. Other proposals, such as term limits and those things, are more controversial constitutionally, but I could see a move to try to amend to allow for term limits or rotation of the court. That, I think, is far more likely than the stacking, but that would require a constitutional amendment because of the life tenure rules that are written in.
Yeah. So why is it so hard to get a new amendment into the Constitution?
It was done that way on purpose. It was meant to be difficult to amend. It was in part because, as I said, the Constitution was a series of compromises, and it was meant to be the overall governing law. And as a result, it was meant to be difficult to amend. And it was meant to try to prevent changes that were capricious or based on public opinion that was likely to change in the future. And I actually think it's one of the great strengths of the U.S. Constitution, rather than the weakness some people have believed it to be.
Well, and it's a pretty good document that's held firm for many years.
It has worked well for the American Republic for most of its history, and I expect it to continue to do so well into the future.
Well, we're out of time, but if people want more information, where can they go?
Yeah, so I would encourage them to go to the NDSU website, which is just ndsu.edu, and then in the search bar put in the Center for Public Choice and Private Enterprise, or PCPE, and they can reach out directly there. The web link is long, and I do not remember it off the top of my head, but if you go to the search bar, drop in PCPE, you'll search for it. My information and others in the center will come up, and we are always happy to chat.
Well, thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me.
You can see the full episode of the Prairie Pulse Show with Ryan Yonk Thursday at 8 p.m. on the television service of Prairie Public. Dakota Datebook is next.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we're joined by Joseph Ellis for a talk about conspiracy theories in America and about gun rights.
Americans are especially susceptible to conspiracy theories. It's deeply woven into the national psyche. Who killed John Kennedy? Who killed Martin Luther King? Did FDR touch off the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941? And so on. Americans, more than most other people, are attracted to this sort of thinking.
And we talk about how that affects the public's view on the ownership of guns.
After every mass shooting in the United States, there is a brief and intense dialogue about guns and gun restrictions in the United States. It almost always ends in nothing. And the question is, how many more shootings will it take before at least we have a rational conversation about gun proliferation in a free society?
Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 14th. Diphtheria was a wicked disease that killed many children in North Dakota's early years. It is caused by bacteria that produce a deadly toxin in the nose, mouth, and throat, forming a membrane from dead tissue that can suffocate a person. diphtheria often sickened whole families, and children were especially vulnerable. In 1898, a Zealand area couple lost 6 of their 8 children in just 26 days. Also in 1898, a diphtheria epidemic struck Bismarck. It began with a 3-year-old boy who died in February after 3 days illness. The wife and 6 children of North Dakota's Commissioner of Agriculture and Labor also fell ill. Their home was fumigated after quarantine. Bismarck school and health officials closed schools for a week, and all homes with diphtheria cases were quarantined. Health authorities made disinfectants and sterilizers available to the public and recommended people avoid gatherings. A North Dakota Agricultural College professor recommended an antitoxin for early treatment and prevention of diphtheria. He wrote to the Bismarck Tribune, "It is but a question of a few years when all infectious diseases will have yielded to the onward march of science." The epidemic in Bismarck appeared to wane in March, but on this date, in 1898, diphtheria was picking up again. Parents kept their children out of school, but by early May, the younger grades were filling up. At least 6 children, ages 6 months to 8 years old, had died in the Bismarck diphtheria scare. Other parts of North Dakota were also hit by diphtheria that spring, including families in Lemoore, Logan, and McIntosh counties. A doctor from the State Board of Health tried to treat and help prevent diphtheria and scarlet fever among Russian settlers, but many families denied having any illness in their homes, even though he found several sick people inside. He said the settlers visited neighbors, held public gatherings, and made no efforts at isolating the sick. He wanted to temporarily suspend church services, but the sheriff wouldn't oblige. He knew he would lose re-election if he closed churches. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merle Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Karen Gibson was retired from the U.S. military when she learned of the attack on the Capitol January 6th.
I never thought I would see American citizens physically attacking the center of our democracy.
Now she's the new sergeant-at-arms for the Senate. What's her plan to secure Congress? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast on the radio, we stream online at prairiepublic.org. After the broadcast or stream, you can find any Main Street show archived as a podcast at prairiepublic.org. Thursday on our show, University of Mary professor Dan Belinsky is auditioning actors for a film he's producing that he's titled End of the Rope. We'll hear about his movie, which is based on the last lynching in North Dakota, on our show tomorrow. And Sue Balcom will join us for Main Street Eats to talk about spelt, a grain similar to wheat. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.